I'd like to thank Sawan Jamhara for inviting me, hosting me again. It's a real delight. Tonight's topic is like reconciliation, meeting in the middle. I'm not going to talk about global political reconciliation at this point. I'm interested in talking how Zazen, our meditation practice, helps towards reconciliation, and how studying with a master, an acharya, Roshi, or Lama, also helps with reconciliation. So I've had the honor of, and maybe how like Vajrayana and Zen are how I do that reconciliation too. So I probably I studied with, of course, Trungpa Rinpoche, and then also Sasaki Roshi, probably thinking maybe just with Joshi Roshi, maybe just at least 30 week-long session, something like that. And then I was also director at Simran Zen Center, Los Angeles, and also founded Boulder Zen Center in Boulder. Sometimes I was doing kind of simultaneous Zen and Vajrayana practice. when my wife got pregnant, when we started being pregnant in L.A., Anne said, we're getting out of here. And moved to up to the foothills, and eventually up to Nevada City. And then there wasn't any, the practice center at that time was, and still is, Ring of Bone Zendo. Anybody been to Ring of Bone? Yeah, lovely, isn't it? So I also studied with Robert Aiken Roshi. So I took Jukai with Sasaki Roshi, and also Robert Aiken Roshi. Did a number of sessions with him and Nelson Foster too, Nelson Foster Roshi. And I've studied with a number of, of course, wonderful Vajrayana teachers. So I appreciate the Mahayana spirit that we have here in Sacramento to take the best and study with the best wherever we find. I think toughest job is reconciliation is like being director of Dharma centers. Like that, you know. I particularly enjoyed a few of the times when I've come to see Roshi talk. I'd like to come more often. It's nice to visit other centers, you know, and visit other people. Also, I had the honor of doing a number of retreats with, in session with Sungsan Sonsanim, like that. And of course, I've been a monk and lived in monasteries in India. I was able to accomplish this through very good karma. I had the good birth of taking birth in a fairly affluent family and inherited a lot of money and spent it all on practice and gave it all away. So my family still talks to me, though. They still don't understand, you know. So today, I want to talk about the inner world and also the Zazen and also practicing with the teacher. For some reason, I was inspired to drop by Time-Tested Books just a week ago. Anybody been to Time-Tested Books on 21st? Yeah. So I picked up a book by a Zen teacher here in Nebraska, Dosho Port, who studied with Katagiri Roshi, who, of course, was at Zen Center for a while. Anybody ever study with Katagiri Roshi? Oh, really? Oh, yeah. I didn't study with Katagiri Roshi, but for me, he had the distinction of he was probably the only person I ever heard Sasaki Roshi say anything really nice about. So he said, oh, very, in Zen style, you probably say, oh, he has very good character. Do they still say that? Like, good character, you know, like that. Yeah, just really good character, you know, strong practice. So this is a book called Keep Me in Your Heart a While, The Haunting Zen of Dainin Katagiri. So Dosho talks about what it's like to study with a teacher and the path. There are not a lot of contemporary books like this, not so much. They're kind of biographies of teachers, but and then, you know, kind of little bloggy things, but not so many books. So it's very useful to read the ancient texts, whether they're koans or biographies, and talk to your teachers about what it's like to study. So I'm going to go into that. In beginning practice, Hinayana practice, we could call it. I don't mean by that Hinayana Theravada or anything, but individual liberation practice. We're developing what I call unipolar mindfulness. We're trying to pay attention basically to one thing at a time. So the idea is that in Vajrayana tradition, you kind of tie a string to what you're meditating on, and you try to hold that a little taut, like a guitar string. So there's kind of a one-to-one thing, or whether you're paying attention to breath or whether you're paying attention to an image. There's this kind of like one mind, one moment correspondence trying to go like that. Does anybody know that kind of practice, right? That makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. We're usually, you know, we're so scattered all the time. So it's a big deal. I mean, it's a huge accomplishment just to be paying attention to one thing at a time, whether it's our rhythm of our breath or an image or internal image or looking at our Buddha and our altar. I always love the tankas here, by the way, and I was reminded that Lionsroar needs a Manjushri tanka. So I'm thinking, so we're going to put that on our Christmas list. Not yours. Yours is safe, but we're going to have that. So in our beginning practice, there's that kind of sense of one-to-one correspondence. In a dualistic way, we could say, you know, we're keeping the object in mind, or non-dualistic way, we're maybe becoming, you know, one with the object, something like that. However, when we enter Mahayana practice, great vehicle and comparable vehicle practice, actually the emphasis is on having two things to pay attention to. So we're not just said to pay attention to one thing, but we have to pay attention to two things at the same time. This is like in Vajrayana, we might say we're paying attention to the rhythm of our breath and paying attention to the image of a Buddha at the same time. The breath is moving, the image is not moving. So assuming we've attained some meditative stability, so when we're looking at something, it's not moving, right? These are opposites, these are polarities. And the mind can do that. We can pay attention to something moving and not moving at the same time. And this style of practice is also further developed in, like in Vajrayana we call like Mahamudra and Dzogchen practice. I think also it is developed in Zen practice also. For me, it's always been most dramatic in doing koan practice. Suzaki Roshi, a lot of koan practice with Roshi and also with Songtsen Nyim and Eiken Roshi also. And these stories always have there's some kind of dialogue, right? So there's a point to them, but there's a dialogue. many times there seem to be like opposing points of view. I'm not giving a koan lecture, that would be presumptuous, but I can hack away a little bit with your permission. But one that sticks to mind, and I don't know whether it's like Blue Cliff Record or Momon Khan or something like that, but there's one story about the Roshi asks someone to like open up the blinds. And says that was great, and then the next person does the same thing and says that was all wrong. And that is really wonderful. So in training in monasteries, and I trained also at Mount Baldy Zen Center for several they call it in Rinzai, call it Seichu, not Ango. Seichu, you say Ango for like 3 months? Don't use that term? Yeah. What would the 3 month retreat? Ango, yeah. Yeah,
practice period.
Yeah, they say Seichu. So, and it was one time you'd go in with some koan and you give the answer, so to speak, your presentation, right? And Roshi would go, good, 75% or something. And you'd think, I'm doing it, yes. And then, you know, in a session, in the ones that Roshi did, you'd amazing, really, an energetic teacher who died only a few years ago at 104. There might be four or five sanzen or dokusan a day. It's brutal because you think, okay, you know, it's like, now what? So you go in again, you give same koan, and you give the same presentation, right? You think, I got it, you know, I'll just get 75%, and then I won't get 100. But what do you think the Roshi would say? Wrong, yeah, no.
You'd go
Roshi 4 or 5 times?
Yeah, yeah. So it was brutal. So, and then no, yes, no, yes, no. this also same in Vajrayana and Zen. So it would be mirrored living in a monastery or training place like Mount Baldy, which is known for being somewhat brutal. You'd have your job, right? And your monastery job, and one day you would do it right, and then one day you would do it wrong. It's basically the same way in Tibetan monasteries too. Like the teacher would think, "Okay, that was good, thanks," and then you do the same next day wrong. Vajrayana, we have a teaching called Four Worldly Dharmas: praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, recognition and ignoring. So the teacher would always be playing on those. Can you hear me okay? Okay. So those are opposites, right? Those are, it's like, you know, sometimes you just get pissed and you'd go, what's that? You know, yesterday was right, or just 2 hours and now it's wrong, and then the next time it's right. So, but that's a very, you know, very Mahayana style. And I know I frustrate some of my students by, like, one day I'll say one thing and the next day I'll say another, or like that. And, of course, we try to figure out that there's a strategy behind it, right? Like, just a kind of a we try to do a strategy, like kind of guessing the stock market or something. Or we try to, like, okay, you know, I'm going to get out of this this deal. You know, I'm not going to play this stupid game of sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong, right? We're just going to. But at some point, after many years, I think, the opposites, both in meditation and in monastery daily life, start to kind of even out. That's a very weird experience, because of course we always kind of think, well, I just want to get it right, I don't want to get it wrong. But they, what you're doing tends to kind of even out. And that evenness experience, you know, of course we say in Brahma Viharas, equanimity, right? But also, you know, we could say, in Vajrayana, we'd say that's dhyana paramita, dhyana, you know, just incredible evenness like that, where nothing is, you know, higher or lower. But that's not the end, you know, so, but it's on, it seems like the end, you know, we get a lot of evenness, and then, you know, I think we're done, right? Because it's amazing not to have emotional conflict, and it's amazing to kind of go, I've chilled, you know, everything's good. As experienced practitioners know, that doesn't last. So, but they establish a kind of evenness, which is essential, but then when there's an evenness, the polarities become very distinct. Not distinct as separate, but like vivid. Let's say in Vajrayana, they become like luminous, or ursal, or radiant, like sawa, like that, you know. And at that point, the instruction is that you want to kind of look through the center. So it's like one's on either side. This is kind of just metaphor, but one's on either side, and you look right down the middle. You're looking right down the middle. One of the, you know, it's your, you know, you've got like two kind of little walls or little markers here, and you can only find the middle by establishing the edges, the edge, and then you can find the middle. You can't find the middle unless you know what the edges are. This is the Mahayana approach. One of the biggest polarities, of course, is the absolute and the relative world. So we talk a lot, in Zen and Vajrayana, I know we talk a lot about Buddha nature, right? The absolute world, right? No birth, no death, that world. kind of awake world sometimes we call it. When we get take refuge or have tantric empowerments, just like taking Jukhai, people get on new names, right? So like in Vajrayana tradition, somebody might be given like my lineage name, Yeshe, which means like awareness, and then Jamyang, which means Manjushri, right? This Manjushri. So that's like absolute world. But there's, there's relative world too, right? You still have your, driver's license self. Isn't that right? Still have that. So these can be polarities, because they are. Like, are we supposed to go in kind of unipolar tradition? We're supposed to go from samsara, personal world, to nirvana, absolute world, right? And to stay there. And some traditions, maybe psychotherapy or maybe existentialism, we just say, just accept the personal world, right? Just accept your limitations. Do you ever hear that? Just accept your limitations, like that. Conditional. Pardon me?
Conditional.
Yeah, conditional world, yeah. But in Mahayana practice, we have to hold both of those together and find the balance, the reconciliation. So in Mahayana, we have a different name for that. We aren't, on the personal side, perfect people, or we're not necessarily emphasizing Buddha. The emphasis and the name in the middle is Bodhisattva, the being that unites the absolute and relative world. Bodhisattva. So the Bodhisattva training is very interesting, because the idea, the motivation, the bodhicitta, the spirit, is this sense of complete balance and non-preference, really, for either the individual world or the absolute world. And a lot of the trainings in Vajrayana, the visualizations and tantras and many of the koans that we've all studied, perhaps. There's a famous koan system, I don't know anything, but Tozan's five ranks, maybe you've heard of that, right? So it's working with that dynamic, right? The absolute and the relative and the absolute, and we're not just working it on the internal world. It's manifesting in our daily life. So in our daily life, it's important to have friends that tell us we're doing great. And is this fading a little bit? Yeah.
It's sinking.
It's sinking, yeah. And when you're sinking in meditation, then you have to look up at the sky. And, is it better?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. So the reconciliation practice in Mahayana is called Bodhisattva practice. Our goal is to manifest the world, that includes, not just excludes or transcends, but includes both polarities like that. So I think it's either, it is very easy practice because we're doing it anyway, or we wouldn't be here. But when we're called upon to do it in the moment, or when we're engaged in emotional or intellectual conflict or conflict with others, then it's very difficult practice, isn't it? Very difficult. There's stages in practice, and I wanted, towards working on this reconciliation, and I wanted to share a little bit before we take some questions, because we end at 8:45, correct? And, yeah, and we want some time for questions and complaints, So, I'm not even like finished this book, but Dosho offers some stages and our growth towards reconciliation, and first stage is idealization. And the second stage is, I'll explain these by reading them, then covert clinging to hopes for magical gain. That's second. I'll explain. Then this is what I like, stage three, extreme crabbiness at self and other. Then four, steadily walking without getting anywhere. Five, experiencing fruition. And then six, falling into the well. When I read this part, I said, okay, this person knows what they're talking about. Especially the falling into the well part, right? So let's, it's just great writing, so I have to read some of it, In the first stage, idealization, Zen seems so cool. We love everybody in the community, and the Zen teacher seems to possess something special, expressing what is in our hearts before we even know it ourselves. I might point out that while we're in this stage, we are particularly nauseating for those that love us the most. We become reborn Zenists spewing Buddha talk that we are not living. The gap between our words and actions is vividly clear to those who really know our lives. This is true of Vajrayana, of course. After a while, the glamour wears off and the practitioner enters the covert clinging to hopes for magical gain stage. We begin to get more sophisticated and cover our original childlike and obvious hopes that somehow Zen is going to resolve our relationship issues, relieve our dysthymia without Prozac, and brighten our teeth. But the hopes continue. While quietly or even unconsciously attached to our utopian dreams, we construct a false, equanimous face with which we lounge around the dojo. Meanwhile, we are not really ready to give up our magical thinking, believing, for example, that if we do Zen correctly, and I'd add Vajrayana, we will be miraculously saved from our lives. That rings so true for me, but sooner or later, depending on in part how fully we throw ourselves into training, a perceived betrayal comes our way, and the very crabby period begins. The trigger need not be dramatic. One friend simply saw his teacher slumping as he dragged himself up a flight of stairs after a long day. After a session, another practitioner discovered her teacher eating potato chips, drinking a beer, and watching TV. That was the end. From this point on in the spiral, Zen utterly sucks, the community is a bunch of nutcases, and the teacher is at best an ordinary person whose fault is that our precious idolization has worn off, or that our stinky self-clinging has been exposed. At this stage, most people quit and go on to something else, imagining that the high of infatuation can be recaptured with another teacher, another tradition, or a softer or harder place. So he goes on and talks about, you know, that gradually our practice becomes integrated through, you know, playing against, working with these polarities, working with our idealization and devaluation, right? Working with our experiences that we think we gain, like an insight, and then we lose them, don't we? We described a session where he was at a meeting at the Minnesota Zen community with Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, and Roshi appointed someone else as head, maybe called Tanto, would that be right? Yeah. And Dosho thought it should be him. So so he described himself, "That's it," I said, as I stood and shoved back my chair. "I'm done with this ineffective, attached to ancient Japanese nonsense." I stormed out of the meeting, vowing to myself never to return to Zen Center. This is still a crabby stage, you know. So, so he goes on to explain. Actually, they got brought together because one of the sangha members passed away, and he decided to go because he loved that person, and he and Roshi showed up at the same time. Yeah. It's interesting, you know. Met again. There's some kind of reconciliation there. Have you ever been really pissed at a teacher and then left, and then there's been some kind of reconciliation? There are famous stories in Zen and Vajrayana literature like that. He goes on. I won't keep quoting, but I'm particularly impressed that he talks about falling into the well, because that's what happens. There's some realization, some stabilization realization. Maybe you're a teacher, and then maybe you get students or a Dharma Center, and then you fall down like that. So, like, shortly after receiving, you know, my particular Dharma transmission, you know, I went through a divorce. You know, just, it was a dive, right? It's like everyone was going, "Oh, well, I don't know what happened," you know? Yeah, so that's another talk, something else to explore. Why, you know, how is it that, you know, even after many years of training and realizations, we could say, you know, genuine experiences, so we still fall into the well. But somehow, and I think the lineage, or I call it the golden thread, can kind of pull us out a little bit. There's something going on there. We can call it bodhicitta. I like calling it golden thread. I've had the good fortune to be really close to my teachers, you know, because I'm kind of nosy. So I really got to know Suzaku Roshi very well, and Trungpa Rinpoche very well, and my lineage teacher Geshe Gyatso well, and, you know, also Eiken Roshi, because I'm not shy, you know, I'll just ask people. So I'll tell the story. Dirk heard me tell the story yesterday, and then take a few questions. So one of my teachers, Chadgud Rinpoche, came to visit Lion's Roar early in the 90s, he by then had married his American wife, Jane, which was his second marriage, by the way. And so we were having tea, and I don't like talking Dharma gossip, do you? I don't know who you've seen, what are you doing? So I just said, "How's the marriage going?" And this is a wonderful teacher. Rinpoche just said, "I still get mad." That's incredible. And that, just right out. right out. Didn't wait. Didn't go. Oh, it's going really good. Yeah. and then Jane pipes up, I do too. Remember, she's so irritating. And then we all laughed, There was a lightness there, right? That's incredible. It's really incredible. Because usually people you want to keep this, particularly, I knew Rinpoche and Jane, but, you keep the a facade going, right? Oh, yes, we practice together, it's lovely, and, just right out like that. So I knew that, Rinpoche and Jane had worked, they'd been down, fallen down the well, and then they came back again like that. I have other great stories, but I'd like to stop here and, appreciate, everyone's listening.
Yeah. I love it that falling down the well is the last stage.
Yeah.
I think that's perfect.
Yeah.
Just when you think you've made it all.
Yeah. I think it is we don't really have a sacrifice martyr tradition in Dharma, but after the Buddha's realization, he almost said, well, maybe nobody will understand, right? Yeah. And so he walked back and forth for, 49 days. And then on his way to Deer Park, he ran into somebody, and, the person said, well, who are you? And he said, well, I'm a Buddha. And the guy said, whatever.
Exactly.
Like that. That's an important stage in practice. Maybe even, really, really awful things can happen to teachers, too, after realization or after they start teaching. Mm. Yeah. So I kind of look for that. Has your path been really smooth? I'm not sure I'd want to study. Particularly. I'm not looking for badness, but down the well, yeah. Yes, sir.
I was interested in your comment that when some equanimity is reached, the polarities, what previously seemed polarities may no longer be pulled in the same way, but become vividly distinct.
Yes.
And your observation about and then you mentioned looking down the middle.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say anything more about looking down the middle. You talk. Yeah.
Basic body level, of course we. We do this a little bit when we sit down, right? And we rock and until we come to that sweet balance spot. So looking down the middle means we're also looking at it and we're feeling the edge like that. So it's feeling both edges at the same time in a sense that are even, and then you kind of trust the process to find that sweet spot because, when you're looking down the middle, you can't go right for it. That's a myth. That's you're talking to a charlatan if they say you can just aim straight for it, right? So it's like this, and then, there's a sense of something like that. That's why, Zen and Vajrayana are esoteric traditions that they have to be, we have to work with our body, speech, and mind and work with other human beings. We can't just get the right information. We need to rock back and forth and feel this is out of balance and that's out of balance, like that. So we have to do this with, it's Tai Chi, push hands. We have to do this a little bit and with fine practice partners. Either we marry them or we study with them or we do projects at Dharma centers with them. So there's that thing. And that's really a joy to find somebody who's willing to say, okay, let's do this. Let's go back and forth till we find that, you know, sweet spot, so that we realize, you know, the Buddha's awakening, of course, is to interdependence, that's the true middle way, right? That's the true bodhisattva practice, is that wonderful interdependence, you know, that it's not one, it's not many, it's not the one and many, it's neither the one and many, you know, like Nagarjuna says, you know. So that's when, you know, that's when me being irritating, being Buddhist studies teacher with like Roshi, then he'd hit you. Like that.
I'm reminded of something our guiding teacher mentioned, a poem some time ago. Tell the truth, but tell it slant.
Tell it slant, yeah, like that. Then someone can see it. So that's interesting. So we start people out doing, you know, meditation practice with shamatha practice, you know, shine in Tibetan. But it's not unipolar. I like to joke, it's bipolar practice, because the one-on-one mindfulness is called drenpa, where you just want, you know, just like the string. But shishing or introspection is coming from the side.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're kind of this, but you're also monitoring the quality of the attention. Is it clear? Is it stable? Is it lax, or is it too excited? So it's like trigonometry or something. Yeah, you have to come at it from the side like that.
Is it vipassana?
No, it's still not vipassana per se, because you're still just doing stabilizing meditation. You know, we would be calling vipassana when you're looking into the essence of something, or how does it work? So how does the self form, or what's the nature of the object, and you know, vipassana in Tibetan is latong, superior seeing or panoramic awareness. You see the situation like that, but they you can't really totally separate them. You know, there's many. You know, you kind of they go together, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So I need a complaint. Yes, go ahead. Oh, you can ask a question. I'm just kidding.
What is falling down the well? I'm thinking it's falling into resignation. I have no idea.
Yeah, I give a little teaser there, so maybe go buy his book. But, you know, just, you know, falling down the well is where we, you know, I think, I haven't finished the book, but, you know, just like getting a divorce, like he went through a divorce. Like, you know, just... we're walking along and we don't see it, and you know, we just fall down. So I don't think it's necessarily like, you know, breaking precepts or becoming, you know, some kind of monster or something like that, right? But it's like, you know, like just something incredibly screws up, so that it doesn't seem consistent with realization that is somewhat idealized. So, you know, that's why a lot of times in lineage traditions like ours, you know, somebody will be told to become like, you know, totally ordinary for a while.
You know, so it's not a bottomless rabbit hole.
No, it's not really hitting that, you know, like I'm bad, stupid, and wrong and should be dead bottom. But it's hitting that... you know, the return to the ordinary world where you're just as much an idiot as everyone else, okay? You know, so you're not, you know, having some kind of special status.
You're a potato chip eater.
Yeah, you're a potato chip eater, exactly. Like that. But it could be, you know, an embarrassing, you know, like situation that, you know, people think that you should have your act together. Because there's still some clinging to, like, you know, like, enlightened people don't have problems, right? So I like to say, kind of taken from recovery, that it's trading, bodhisattva practice is trading one set of problems for a better set of problems, like that. Yeah, thanks for asking that. Yeah, it doesn't mean you're totally becoming like horrible, you know, monster breaking precepts, but it's a rapid return to ordinary, you know, seeing yourself as ordinary. In Vajrayana, we would call it you're being protected by the Dharmapalas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like that. You know, I always think, oh, it's good. It's good. We need ordinary kind of just to be reminded, you know, we're stuck in traffic jam, but I still don't like it. You know, so what is it in Genjo Koan? You know, we still don't like the weeds, right? What was the famous teacher that said, Roshi, Katagiri Roshi was talking about, like, people ask for the death poem and the teacher said, I don't want to die. It's like that, you know. But he owned it, you know, he owned it. And it's really special, just like Chagyur Rinpoche. Yeah, that exposed, you know. So that's owning the well, you know. So we say fall down the well. It doesn't necessarily mean like you're losing your practice. It just means like suddenly, you know, like you're just completely ordinary. Yeah.
It's a really heightened practice.
It's a heightened practice, yeah. You know, you're still ordinary, but you still have to do the job. So it's kind of like total phony. Like you feel it's phony, but you can do the job. But, you know, so if teacher says, I'm giving you transmission and you feel like, yeah, I got it. Yeah, I deserve that. Then that's a dangerous position. Right. You know,
I remember a story about Suzuki Roshi going around hitting his students saying, who's the teacher? Who's the student?
Yeah, like that. It's very intimate, you know, So. You know, so my teacher used to say, get up and how are you doing? You know, Geshe-la, and go, I'm depressed. You know, like that. It's 8:45. Like that. So I know some of you have obligations. So that's an ordinary world too, a particular world we have to honor. Like, okay, honey, I said I'd be home by 9, you know, so I know what that's like, you know. Isn't that right? Yeah.